Welcome to the Scientific American Podcast Science Talk, posted on August 3rd, 2014. I'm Steve Mirsky. On this episode,
if you look at very early life forms, like single cell life forms, they divide all the time and they don't age in a way.
That's science fiction author Mark Alpert. Mark got a degree in astrophysics from Princeton and became a Scientific American writer and editor. A few years back, he left to become a respected novelist. You've heard him on previous podcast episodes after the publication of his earlier books, Extinction and Final Theory. His latest is The Furies. We spoke about it at his apartment on Manhattan's Upper West Side. Mark, it's difficult to talk about a novel because I don't want to give too much away. So why don't you just tell as much as you want about the plot and the science in the plot? And I've read the book, so I can jump in there and try not to ruin, you know, with any spoilers. But take it away, Marky.
As you know, I'm a writer of science thrillers. And my previous books have dealt with Albert Einstein and the Final Theory, and also with neuroscience in my last book, Extinction. But for The Furies, it's a little bit different. I wanted to move more in the direction of fantasy, but still keep it a science thriller. You know, I love fantasy books. I love the Harry Potter books. But I'm the kind of guy who, when I read those books, I say to myself, exactly how do those Quidditch brooms work? I mean, what exactly, what kind of anti-gravity phenomena are they using to make this work? So I love fantasy, but I wanted to keep it scientifically, give a scientific basis for it. So I've always been fascinated by witches, and my son was writing a term paper about the Salem witch trials. And what he discovered was that the Salem witch trials were really very small compared to the witch hunting that was going on in Europe at the time. In the Salem witch trials, 20 people died. In Europe, tens of thousands of people were massacred in the 16th and 17th centuries, mostly in France and Germany, and mostly women. It was this gender genocide that was going on, and it was really just those centuries. It wasn't so much in the Middle Ages. A lot of people think maybe the Reformation or the Counter-Reformation had something to do about why there was this mass hysteria and killing of women in these villages in Germany and France. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if there was something real there, if there really were witches of a sort, a family that had some genetic distinction. You know, witches back then, a sign of a witch back then was red hair and green eyes. And I thought, okay, that sounds like a sex-linked genetic characteristic. So what if there was a family where there was something, you know, genetically distinct about them, stemming from a mutation from perhaps hundreds of years before, that made them so different from the surrounding population that they were persecuted and massacred? So I thought, this will be interesting. This will be a clan. I'll call them the Furies. And they lived in Europe, and they were massacred, almost annihilated. And then the few survivors came to America, and they settled in the wilderness of the Great Lakes, in what is now the Upper Peninsula of northern Michigan. And they've been living there for the past 400 years, rebuilding the family, guarding their secrets, pretending to be an Amish community, separating themselves from the outside world. And in the present day, there is a civil war among the Furies, and their secrets are about to come out. And my hero is an outsider named John Rogers, who meets one of these Furies and falls in love with her, of course, and is swept into this civil war and learning about the secrets of this genetically distinct family.
You have the main Fury. Fury's the last name of the family,
right,
by the
right.
way. So the Furies obviously has connotations, but that's the name of the group. You have her say at one point that to use the word witch is really bad.
Well, that's what they accused them of being when they killed them. So I thought, you know, it would be interesting if for them this was a terrible term that they would never use, that they don't think of themselves as witches, that they actually see themselves as having sort of a holy purpose as steering the course of human history, because this family has been in existence for hundreds of years, that they actually have this long-term plan for moving humanity toward peace rather than war. And it's a matriarchal clan. It's run by a council of elders who are all women, and they have, you know, goals As far as it sort of is similar to the standard idea of a witch, that these witches involve themselves in human events, but it's sort of turning the idea around by giving them a benevolent goals instead of the evil goals that people have always ascribed to witches.
Now, again, I don't want to give too much away, but there's an excellent reason why, a very pragmatic reason why the elders are all women.
You know, there's always a question, again, with the spoilers. I don't want to give away too much. And it's related to what makes the Furies genetically distinct from the surrounding population. Getting into the science now, what I found was that if you look at very early life forms, like single-cell life forms, they divide, you know, all the time, and they don't age in a way, because in the same way that multicellular organisms do, because we're more complicated and our bodies run down and we have to basically regenerate ourselves with each generation. But with single-celled organisms, they can divide for long periods of time without with staying pretty much genetically identical to their ancestors. And in the Furies, I create this. I try to get into the actual mutation that created the Furies, and it had something to do with something that's on the X chromosome, that the chromosome rearranged itself, and this resurrected the gene that is the same thing that keeps unicellular organisms, what maintains their DNA in a pristine level, so that basically the Furies do not age.
Right.
So they have the gene which improves cellular repair.
The female Furies.
It's sex-linked, right. It was just like the red hair and the green eyes. This is a sex-linked trait, so that the females, only the females have this longevity. They can still die. They're not immortal. They could still die from, accidents or homicides or something like that, but they do not age, whereas the men do age. And another effect of the same gene is that it produces the proteins that the gene produces interfere with the genes on the Y chromosome that have to do with fertility. So all the males' Furies are, not only are they not, long-lived, but they're also infertile, which is a double whammy for them. And what happens is the Furies, in order to sustain themselves, they actually have to go outside their community and mate with ordinary men. And in order to maintain their secrecy, they impregnate themselves, and then they return to their community without a
relationship.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's how John Rogers, who's the hero of this book, meets Ariel, who's the Fury, who he encounters at a bar, and they have a little tryst. And then, of course, it doesn't go according to plan, because there is now a war among the civil Furies. The men have learned, because in recent times, the Furies are aware of the same genetic research that, the outside world is. And they've come to realize that they've come to pinpoint the gene which is responsible for the long life of the women. And of course, the men are saying, we want to have this gene too. Is there any way that we can avail themselves of the same protein that's giving the women a long life? So they start agitating for this, and it leads to a civil war between the men and the women, because the main priority of the women is that they do not be discovered. They want to keep their family as secret as possible. And so some of the men rebel, they leave the community, they start killing each other, and this is a civil war that John Rogers, the hero of the Furies, gets involved in, and that is how he learns about their existence.
You keep calling him the hero. I thought she was the hero.
Yeah, well, sure. She's the heroine, he's the hero.
All right. I really thought of her as the main character, and he was a major supporting character.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, she's probably more interesting in that, in the sense that what would it be like to live for 400 years? I mean, if...
Well, that's really key, because the science aspect of the book in large part revolves around the fact that, let's say we buy the premise that they're incredibly long-lived, that enables them to engage in research projects as scientists themselves, and because they are very serious scientists. And they have this expanse of time to engage in various research projects that no actual scientist would be able to do or even consider. I mean, if I'm not going anywhere, I'm going to start doing some research that I understand is going to take me 300 years. It would change your entire outlook on what kinds of things you could investigate.
Right. Yeah. I think I wrote this book because I was frustrated by the limits of the human lifetime. I mean, I guess everyone feels at some level, I wish I could live longer. There are so many things I want to do. Well, imagine if you really did have the opportunity to live for hundreds of years and you could indulge in all of your passions and interests. It would be great, but there would also be a possible negative effect because you would think, well, I have all this time. Why do anything? Why can't I just put off everything? And there's also the possibility that over time you might lose the will to live because you might see that your long life has become sort of a sentence in some way. And in order to live for that long, I think you would have to dedicate yourself to a purpose. You would have to have even a more purpose-driven life than you would in just a 70-year or an 80-year lifetime. So that's why so many of these theories take up, they need a purpose. They need either a scientific purpose to learn about the world or a purpose to improve society.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that the men complain about is they think that at least some of the women, because of their extreme longevity, no longer consider the men to be, let alone equal, but even worth having anything to do with, because they're such short-lived people that to the women who live for hundreds of years, these guys never really attain any kind of maturity.
Right. Yeah. And I thought what made me think of that was I was imagining a mother who is giving birth to generations of children over hundreds of years, and her sadness upon seeing the men who might die of normal old age after 70 or 80 years. And for her, that's really no time at all. And I would imagine that some women at a certain point might not want to invest so much emotion in their sons because they know that the sons would be dying before them. And so they would very maybe unconsciously give more emotional investment in their daughters than their sons. And of course, this would lead to even more resentment among the sons.
Let me ask you something, and we haven't talked about this. I'm throwing this at you from left field, but as a person who knows a lot of science, did you consider trying to find a telomere explanation for the longevity, or did you decide to just go with this genetic mutation?
I didn't want to make it too complicated. Mm-hmm. I mean, telomeres, obviously there's been a lot of research about how they're involved in protecting when they get shortened, I think. But that's what leads to, excessive degradation of the chromosomes. I did a fair amount of research into aging, and it gets wonderfully complex. There's questions about DNA repair. There's also questions, I believe, about the cellular junk just accumulates. I think it's the lysosomes, is it? Those little vacuoles in the cell where basically there's this indigestible stuff that starts accumulating in cells. And I thought this was fascinating, but I couldn't put too much detail into the book. So basically I left it at sort of a general level that there was a rearrangement of the genes that would encourage greater DNA repair, and therefore aging wouldn't have an effect. The one point I made was an evolutionary biology point, which is that this type of gene would not necessarily be favored as the animal kingdom developed from the unicellular kingdom, because as far as evolution is concerned, it doesn't care how long any individual lives. It's the amount of offspring that you produce,
right, and their fitness.
Yeah. Right. So if this gene in some way hurts your ability to reproduce, and the Fury's gene does hurt their ability to produce. I think half of all their embryos are automatically are not viable. So you would see how this.
Yes, you have a Punnett square in the book.
Yeah, I put that in.
that shows that.
Right. So I thought, well, it sort of makes sense that any gene for long.
That's just our ride. We'll be back in a moment after. After these words from the New York City Police Department.
Sorry about that.
That's all right. It's all part of doing business.
It's life in New York.
It's life in a big city, man.
Mm-hmm. So the point I was trying to make was that this gene for long life was not selected for as animals arose because it just hurt their reproduction. So it sort of makes sense that it would disappear from evolution in
and
some
in
ways.
In fact, we see much higher rates of cancer with longevity in many cases. You sort of have it both ways. You design for your plot a mutation that confers long life, but also keeps the chromosomes repaired.
Right. I guess the gene for long life improves the efficiency of cellular repair, including DNA repair. And I believe that the current theory about cancer is that there has been some kind of mutation that happens in some of the cells. This genetically different cell has no limits on cell death, or and so it reproduces wildly. And what makes it interesting is that this is a very difficult thing to fight, because if you develop a chemotherapy that can control that that cancer, then maybe it works for, you know, 99 out of 100 of the cancer cells. But then there's one that's a little genetically different from the others. It's resistant to the drug. And because this cancer cell has no controls on its cell growth, then therefore that cancer will soon dominate over all the other varieties. So the
you're doing massively
resistance.
Efficient selection.
Right, right.
From an evolutionary point of view within the tumor cells.
Right. And that's why people become, that's why chemotherapy often doesn't work more than a few months.
Right. So you have other science in the book. You have geothermal energy. You've got the clan there in their secret hideaway has developed a really efficient way to draw energy from geothermal sources.
Right. The Furies, like I said, are up in the Upper Peninsula of Northern Michigan. If you've ever been there, there's not much there. You know, it's a very isolated area, and there's thousands of these Furies, and over time, they realized we have to hide ourselves from the world. And so they started building more and more things underground. And eventually, they realized they needed their own underground energy source. Because, as you know, they were posing as an Amish community. And Amish communities do not go on the power grid. They're allowed to use their own generators, but they mm-hmm. cannot go on the utility grid. So I had to create their own power source. And so I did a little research on geothermal energy. And actually, there are some limestone karst caves in the Upper Peninsula. Mm-hmm. So it's not too unrealistic that they could be building underground there.
Do you think, this was something else that I was thinking about when I read the book, you think it's possible today for a couple of thousand people to be living in a community that's hidden away without some government agency figuring out that something weird is going on there?
Yeah. Well, in my book, the FBI starts poking around and realizing, you know, this Amish community, they're buying a lot of building materials, and it looks pretty suspicious. But there is a hesitancy to do anything about it, because, again, it's a religious community, and you don't want to the government putting its nose into that too much. I thought that was one of the most fun things about the book, is creating this completely different society mm-hmm. That has its own government, that has its own security force, that has guardsmen who are posing as Amish farmers, you know, walking the perimeter of this compound. They also have a group called the Rangers, who are people who go into the outside world to serve whatever purposes the Furies need. I mean, this family has been around for 400 years, and in order to secure its future, it's made some investments over the years, and so they have people who work, you know, on Wall Street, who handle the family's finances, and they have people who go out and investigate scientific discoveries in the outside world that could possibly be useful for the Furies. So it was fun.
And you also have to bring in a lot of guns.
Yes, yes. They
I figured that might attract somebody's attention. They're hoarding thousands of weapons at this point.
Well, it is a thriller, of course. But you know, this country, weapons are pretty easy to secure. You know, that doesn't surprise me in the least that someone would be able to accumulate a large number of assault rifles.
Were they paying their grazing fees? Is what I'd like to know.
Well, they. I guess it's their farm. I tried to actually do the numbers on this. Yeah. Their farm is about a 1,000 acres, yeah, and they grow a certain amount of corn, and they have a certain number of cattle. And I figured this might be enough to support a population of 1,000 or 2 people living underground.
Uh-huh. That was a Cliven Bundy reference, but never mind. You said at the beginning of the interview you'd always been fascinated by witches. Why do you think that's true?
I think part of it is just the mystery of something different out there, something outside of our experience. I mean, why do we write novels? It's what catches your imagination. You know, I have children when they were younger. I read them the Harry Potter books, and I thought part of what I loved about the Harry Potter books was in every book, J.K. Rowling did something different, introduced some interesting, you know, fun element that that just captured your imagination. But also, I think in all of my books, I deal with this whole problem of being a little obsessed with death. Of course, I think everyone, every writer, a lot of writers are, I should say, especially myself, we're just obsessed with death and thinking out, why do we write in the first place? We want to leave some record of who we are, you know, behind. And
Rather than saying you're obsessed with death, maybe you're actually obsessed with immortality.
Yeah. It seems like, you know, it would be a wonderful dream. And I thought to create a family that that could live for centuries, the people in this family could live for centuries, would be a wonderful dream. But I started to think to myself, well, what would be the downsides of this? You know, the oldest Fury of them all is named Octavia Fury. And she was named Octavia after the Roman emperor under whose reign she was born, Octavius. So she's lived for more than 2,000 years. But at some point, she went insane because she realized that even for someone who doesn't age, she's lived way past what you'd expect. You would think that over that amount of time, some accident would have killed her by now. And so she lives in terror of dying. And they have to keep her in a locked room and with where there's no sharp objects. And she's constantly worried that her caretakers are going to poison her. And John Rogers, who's the outsider who comes into the Fury's world, visits this woman. And it's an education for him to realize that, you know, sometimes maybe the idea of living forever is not would not be as wonderful as you'd expect.
Do you know what your next book is yet?
I do. I have a contract to write two more books.
Great.
So that's exciting. Except the next one is due in November, and I've only written one chapter, so I've got a lot to go. It's going to be sort of an offbeat alien invasion story.
Excellent.
Based on something that I wrote for Scientific American. Well, actually, I edited a story about, you know, 10, 12 years ago, mm-hmm. about if interstellar travel were actually possible, what kind of form would it take? And it was a story. It was actually by Timothy Ferris, mm-hmm. who I edited his story, where he said, you're unlikely to see a Starship Enterprise coming from another solar system because it's just too big. It's too expensive and too massive an undertaking to transport something so large from one solar system to another. If anything were to travel between solar systems, it would be something really small, like
right.
maybe the size of a grapefruit.
Right.
But it would be a self-replicating probe
right.
so that it could land on whatever planet it wanted to, and then quickly it would have simple tools enough to utilize the local resources and start building machines so that it could create more of a presence for itself. And so that's the thing that I imagine lands right here.
Very cool. And that's due in November.
Yeah, so that'll probably come out either next year or probably by the end of next year.
Very cool. We're looking forward to it.
Thanks, Steve. I appreciate it.
That's it for this episode. Get your science news at our website, www.scientificamerican.com, where you can learn how to build a solar oven out of a pizza box. The recipe is in the education section. And follow us on Twitter, where you'll get a tweet whenever a new item hits the website. Our Twitter name is at SCIAM, S-C-I-A-M. For Scientific American Science Talk, I'm Steve Mirsky. Thanks for clicking on us.